Welcome to Fund with Fundraising. I'm Deanna Lund, your host. I am a small business owner, author, and speaker. And in this podcast, I will be sharing interviews with interesting people. You will also hear my fundraising journey, so you guys can follow along while I hit my 2021 goal. Today, I am joined by Kelly Snyder, and I am looking forward to talking to her. She has been in fundraising for 20 years. Correct me if I'm wrong, over 20 years. So welcome, Kelly. Thank you for joining me.
I'm super excited to chat with you.
It's going to be amazing. Kelly, tell me about what got you into fundraising and what is it that you're doing?
Wow. Well, I was working a job in retail, and it was really because I just needed to make an income. And I'd done retail for years. I'd managed retail stores. I'd worked in clothing and in food and all kinds of things. And so I took a job to just earn some money and pay the bills. And the first shift was 4 hours. I was unpacking clothes all day. And at the end of the 4 hours, I actually found myself crying on the sales floor because it just so wasn't what I wanted to do. So I went to the manager.
Actually crying.
Oh yeah. I had tears coming down. I was just like, this is not where I need to be. So as I finished my shift, I went to the manager and I said, hey, thanks for the opportunity, but I'm not going to come back. And then, so I went home and I'm like, okay, now what? And I asked myself a question of what do I like doing so much? I would do it for free. And I realized I was already doing it as a volunteer. I'd been planning fundraising events. So auctions, small events for my church, for friends who are going on missions trips, for local organizations and camps to help them raise money. And it wasn't huge amounts of money. It was like $2,000 here, $5,000 there, but it made a difference for them. And so I realized, well, I love doing this. I'm already doing it for free on my spare time. What if I could get paid to do this? And that started my journey in fundraising. I got a job working for the Canadian Cancer Society, being the administrator on their big gala, their yearly gala, big black tie event for 600 people with a huge auction and dinner and dancing, all of the things.
As the very first job, you're arranging a black tie event?
Yes. There was a team of three of us, but that was my first paid job, and it was a year-long contract. And I was like, finally, I'm getting paid for doing something I love doing and that I'm doing already. And that has started this 22 to 23-year journey now of raising money for different charities, basically doing events and all kinds of events, which is really one of the most fun parts of fundraising.
What's your absolute favorite event to make, put on?
Oh, good question. I would have to say the one that I loved the most was actually a 10-week motorcycle trip around North America. It was, again, for cancer. It was for raising awareness of mitigating our risks of getting cancer. It was called the Answer for Cancer Tour, and it was 9 summers ago. And we had 2 motorcyclists and a naturopathic doctor and me that did pretty much the whole trip. 30,000 kilometers over the course of 10 weeks. And it was every state in the continental US and all the Canadian provinces. So we didn't hit Alaska or Hawaii, and we didn't get the Canadian territories. But over that 10 weeks, we covered, like I said, 30,000 kilometers. We visited, I don't even know how many cities anymore. But it was such a great chance for me, not only to see my country and the US, but to interact with people that we couldn't have planned interacting with. So it was exhausting. It was incredibly exhausting, but it was also so fulfilling.
Okay. So one, how in the world do you get an idea like that? And two, how do you plan it? Because like you're saying, there's a lot of interaction you couldn't even have thought of. So how much of it is planned in advance and how? But first, how do you get the idea?
Okay. To start with the idea, and this is the best part of fundraising for me because I do events, is finding those things that you already love, or that you're if you're an organization who is raising money or an individual helping an organization, what is it that you already love doing and that you're super excited about? So for that event, it was these two guys who have a passion for riding their bikes, and they would often go on 2 or 3 week trips, just the two of them, up to Alaska or down to Utah or like wherever. And they just decided one day they were going to do an epic trip where they were going to go to the East Coast of the US. And then they thought, well, if we're going to do that, why don't we do all the states? And then they're like, well, if we do that, why don't we actually like take additional time off work and do the states and Canada? Because we have to come back. And then they're like, okay, if we're going to be gone for this long, we should do it for something. Like we should have a purpose. And so that's really how it developed from like an idea to, okay, what does this look like? And then I got involved first as a volunteer. And then when they realized what I do, what I did for a living and I plan events, I became part of the planning team. And you, with something like that, you start with a route. And we started with, okay, what does this look like? And where are the stops we're going to take overnight? And then you, it's just one step at a time. And that, like we said, there are tons of things that happen that you can't account for. And that's the same in any event. I mean, I've got so many stories around things that went wrong or the challenges we had in setting up events or anything, but you have to go with whatever happens. And that's what I love about events too, is you can't plan for everything. So that's like how you get the idea and a little bit of the planning. It's just what's the logical next step that we need to cover.
So you, all four of you were riding bikes or motorcycles?
No, I wasn't. And the naturopath, the naturopathic doctor was not. We were in a support vehicle. Half the time it was like an RV type of motorhome type of vehicle. And half the time it was a little SUV, like a rental from place to place, because the RV broke down a lot. or there were places the RV couldn't go because it was big and long. And so it was the naturopathic doctor and I, well, I was the logistical person. So I worked with one of the riders every day, every night to plan the route for the next day so that we weren't just on freeways, because that's no fun. And especially not fun for people on bikes, on motorcycles. It's a lot more dangerous that way. And you want to be on a scenic route.
You also want to be places where you can stop and talk to people about the course.
Exactly. Yeah. And so like stops at gas stations or at restaurants or parks where we would like grab some food at a grocery store or a deli and go and sit in a park. And you never know who you're going to run into, what discussions you're going to have. So that was the exciting part, is never knowing like at what stop at a gas station or whatever, who we'd interact with, like little kids and parents. And if I think about some of the photos we have, people towing horse trailers and interactions with the horses and servers in restaurants. And one of the guys on his bike, he was out washing his bike one night at a car wash, and he ran into some guy and had a like hour and a half conversation with this gentleman who had just been diagnosed with cancer. And those were like the super meaningful parts of the trip where you go, you can't replace this with anything else.
Wow. And what did you plan it in advance? Because that sounds like that. Okay. I don't want to say I would die to do that, but it seems like a really cool trip to take, I have to say. But I'm thinking like, okay, so we want to go to San Francisco and we're going to set up something in San Francisco, like an event or something while we're there. And then it's just, we know that in 5 days, then we're going to be in San Diego and then we're having something set up there already. And then we'll see what comes along of conversations and people we meet along the way between those two cities. Or was everything kind of just as you go? And also, how did you promoted along the way? Like, did you have vests on that said Cancer Society, or how did people know that that was what you were there to talk about?
Good questions. So our planning included each night stop. So we knew what city we wanted to get to, and we booked hotels the whole way around. So for all 65 nights, I think it was. We also planned a day off every week. So there was one day where we had two nights in the same place. And that's when we could make some bigger plans around events. If we knew people in those areas, and often we had people in those areas that helped us plan gatherings. We had an extra day in Phoenix, Arizona. And so we actually had a couple of events planned there. One was we connected with a motorcycle group that had a weekly ride, and we did a ride with them and then had a gathering at the end spot, which was a restaurant. And then the next day we had a chance to sleep a little bit and do some laundry on the day off. But then we also had a gathering at a restaurant that was actually, their patio was like a beach with sand and everything. It wasn't a real beach, but it was set up as a beach with tents and sand. And so it felt like, you know, you were in a more relaxed environment than a restaurant. And we set up our signs and, because we had signs and everything, and we had some cards that we handed out. And yes, the guys on the motorcycles had motorcycle jackets and vests, depending on, you know, what the weather was like, that had our logo on the back. And when we had our RV with us, the RV was all logoed with our image and our colors and everything. So people would ask questions. And we had t-shirts and jackets and hats. Like, we had all kinds of things that just had the little logo on them. And that's how we'd have conversations in restaurants. Like, a server would comment on our shirts and say, "Oh, your shirt says Answer for Cancer." And then would start a conversation based on what was going on with her life and someone in her life who had cancer. Things like that.
I love the tagline, I have to say. That's really, really nice. I want to do this.
Well, and I think that's the key, is everybody around the world is doing so many cool things to raise money. And it inspires us to go, hey, it would be great to do something like this. It would be great to do something like this. And I work with a lot of different organizations. And the one thing I can say is, don't mimic what someone else has done. Make it suit your organization or suit what it is that you're wanting to get across in terms of your message, your story. Our stories are so important because that's what we connect with. So on the motorcycle tour, it was us telling our story of what we were doing, but also allowing other people to tell their stories of their experiences with cancer, of their own, their loved ones, however it affected them, because we're all affected in some way or another now in our world today. It's not rare for us to know someone or be close to someone who has had cancer if it's not ourselves. And so, like, I've worked with the Grizzly Bear Foundation here in Vancouver, which is all about building conservation around the grizzly bear population, which are an endangered population because as a society, we're expanding into their natural habitats. And they wanted to do a big awareness event. And my suggestion to them for their auction was to not do what everyone else does for an auction, but to make it themed to the grizzly bear. So to have everything that was in their auction relate in some way to the grizzly bear. So the items we had, besides artwork, which is amazing, when you can get amazing artwork of grizzlies, it's so phenomenal. I love them. They're majestic creatures. But also we had here in BC, in British Columbia, our licenses, they were doing parks licenses to raise money for the parks system in BC, and they had grizzly bears on them. And we got the provincial licensing to donate a package of grizzly bear license plates to the auction. We had bear-proof garbage cans for residential garbage cans that are bear-proof, because we have bears in our neighborhoods, not grizzlies generally. We have black bears, but we tried to do that. Trips were for grizzly bear viewing or for salmon fishing, which is what grizzly bears feed on a lot of the time. So always trying to connect everything to the cause, because people, then it was different. It was exciting. And everything that they looked at connected to what we were raising money for.
That's so smart. And also being a bit creative with the connections to the cause. I think that's amazing. I want to go back to, I can hear that you have so many interesting stories, but I want to go back to the motorcycle trip a little bit more, because I'm wondering, because you were then paid, and I'm guessing the doctor was as well. My question is, who were paying you? Was that the organizations you were working for, or was that the two guys who were biking, or how did that work?
So the whole fundraising process for the trip and for our charities, because we connected to two charities with this. Answer for Cancer isn't a charity in its own. We connected to a charity in the US and a charity in Canada that we would that we donated funds to at the end of the day. So the fundraising process was a lot of sponsorship to, and they got logos. We did sponsorship packages. And yes, I'm an expert in fundraising events and in building things like that, sponsorship and getting those images out there and the ways that we can connect with community organizations that have that kind of funding to help with something like this. But then we also had people sponsor us, and we also had people who donated on the road at events and things like that. And the reason that we had two charities was because we wanted to make sure that anybody donating in the US, it went to a US charity, and it, same thing in Canada, because we were crossing borders and it just made it a little bit more confusing. So all the funds raised, we raised, I think, over $800,000. It was a while ago now. But that didn't all go to charity, because some of it covers the cost of an event. As anybody in fundraising knows, events are one of the most expensive ways to raise money, but they're also about expanding your reach to people that aren't already connected to a charity. And so you expect that. So of that money that was raised, it covered the costs for all of us on the road. It paid me a small amount because my costs were also being covered. It wasn't a lot. And then there were also a couple people in Vancouver who were earning money and working on this, doing marketing, publicity, logistics, when we couldn't do it on the road, because we're more connected now than we were 9 years ago, almost 10 years ago. But there were spots on the road where we couldn't get connected, where we had issues that came, lots of issues that came up, like everything from tires blowing out to bikes breaking down to broken other things and needing to fix them. But that was another reason why we had one day off a week, was so that the bikes could get new tires, could be tuned up, could be checked out before another 5,000 kilometers or something. There's a lot of logistics that go into a trip like that. So I actually don't remember what we raised at the end of the day. When we came back about 2 months later, we had a gala dinner where we also showed a movie and had a little auction and stuff like that. So we raised more money there. And I wasn't doing the finance part, which is why I don't know the total numbers. I was doing logistics.
I love that you're like, and then we finished and we just had a gala just to raise a bit more money, because we might as well just use what we have, right? And get as much money in as possible.
Yeah. But also people wanted to celebrate what had been done. I mean, we'd been on the road for 10 weeks and people were following our journey through blog posts and social media and stuff like that. And it was before we use social media so much more now. I actually think it would be fun to do it again and just see what we could do.
I'm in.
Where social media has come, but it was exhausting. And so like, it would be hard to do it again because it was so draining.
I would guess that it would actually maybe also be more draining with the social media presence today, because I would guess that you would then not post as much as would be needed today to get the same awareness.
Oh, totally.
Be my thought.
Yeah, I feel like then it was more Twitter. There was a little bit on Facebook because we had a Facebook page, but it was mostly Twitter on a daily basis. And I was managing 3 or 4 people's Twitter accounts because I was in the support vehicle and sometimes I had internet while they were riding and they couldn't do stuff.
I'm happy to hear that they're not riding bikes and tweeting at the same time. That would be a whole different cause to raise money for if they were doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that actually answered my other question.
And honestly, there were times where we were in parking lots like of motels and getting ready to leave for the day. And we left, some days started at 6 a.m., 7 a.m., depending on how long it was going to take us to get to our next location. And we would be packing up all our gear and getting ready to go, and people would come up to us in parking lots and hand us $20 bills, $50 bills, like just wanting to do something.
Amazing. What did you do with that? Because would you just deposit that?
Well, yeah, that was tricky. The people who were managing all the finances and everything actually would join us every someone would join us every 10 to 14 days. So often I would keep it, use it for petty cash and receipts and all that stuff, and then hand it off to them and let them deal with it every couple of weeks.
Fair enough. Because today you would use something like Venmo, I think it's called, in the US.
In the US, Venmo, we don't have that in Canada. So it is a little bit more complicated when you're dealing with two countries, but there are lots of ways. There's so many more ways of doing it now, which is awesome.
Yeah. I'm so excited by this trip, and I could ask so many more questions, but I also want to hear a bit about what's the least exciting event you've done, or not. It's maybe a bad question. I'm thinking, like, what didn't work out the way you planned? What was the biggest fiasco, if you want to share?
You know, every event that I've worked on has had its pluses and minuses, and every event has had its disasters as well. And it, not necessarily disaster in how it turned out, but disaster in putting it together or whatever. Like, I've done a gala for 13 years. It's a wine and food gala, and it raises money for the arts. And one morning we're setting up, and we do a day and a half of setup before the event because it's elaborate, a lot of wine in the auction because it's a wine part of a wine festival. And we were setting up, we were just getting ready to start setting up centerpieces for the tables, and all volunteer done and everything. And we had joked like a few weeks before, it would be fun to have a water feature, like some kind of fountain or something, but that's super expensive, right? Anyways, the volunteer in charge of the centerpieces and the decor goes into the ballroom to start setting up her volunteers and get all the vases and everything. And she comes out and she goes, I know we joked about a water feature, but there's actually a flood happening and the whole wall is a waterfall. And I went in there and literally a pipe above in the ceiling, the jacuzzi was above us and a pipe in the jacuzzi had broken. And there was water pouring down one whole wall against the electrical room, which was scary enough. But also, like, this was a major disaster. Like, there was sheets of water coming down. It wasn't just drips. and that's at 10 o'clock in the morning, and my guests are arriving at 5 o'clock. I mean, total disaster, right? And you kind of freak out. But it's also what I love about events is you can't plan for everything. And so here I am, I'm like trying to figure out, okay, what are our options? I walk around the floor of the venue that we're in to see what other rooms are available. I've done lots of events there. And I'm like, okay, we could move the dinner to this room with the auction across the hall. We're going to have to bust our butts, but we're going to get this done. And it's going to be a lot of work, but we could be ready. And so I go to talk to the hotel, and their banquet staff are already and janitorial staff are already trying to figure it out. I talked to my person. I'm like, okay, here's what I think we could do. And he was like, let's hold off for a second. We've turned off the water. I think we can make it so that nobody's going to know. And literally at 5 o'clock, when guests are starting to walk into the ballroom, they had like 20 layers of towels just to catch all the drips. There was one drip left, and I stood under it as guests walked in so nobody would get dripped on. And nobody knew that that had happened in the morning except people who had visited during the day and had seen what was going on. But you make things happen. And if you're working with good venues and good suppliers and great volunteers, it all comes together. That's what I love about doing events, is that troubleshooting, that stuff you can't plan for, that kind of shoots that adrenaline into you and puts you into high gear. And you're like, we're going to make this happen, and nobody's going to know that it was a problem.
Yeah. Wow. I'm amazed. That sounds, I would have been a bit, felt the pressure. Let's say that.
Oh, I did. And then I was like, no good for anyone for the next 3 days after the event. Like, I was,
that makes
so
sense. Okay. So if, let's say that you're working as a volunteer and you want to set up some event for the charity of your choice, like whatever it is, if you want to, what would be a good starter event? If you haven't been doing events like that, and if you haven't been fundraising a lot before, what would you think, what would you suggest as a great starter event?
I would, as I said before, I would start with something you already love doing. So if you're a runner or a walker or a hiker or something like that. Do something you're passionate about and then figure out how to make it raise money. Because if you're passionate about whatever that activity is, you're going to draw people in to support you and to do it alongside you. And then you can figure out how to raise money from it pretty easily. But it's the activity that's the hard part to figure out, because you want it to be something you're not going to want to give up on, or something you're not going to, you don't want to dislike what you're doing. So if you're not into fancy dinners or auctions or like dressing up and paying a lot of money to go to an event like that, don't plan an event like that because you're not going to enjoy it. You, especially when it's volunteer driven, you want your volunteers and everybody that comes alongside you to really enjoy what you're doing and to have fun. That's why people volunteer, like not just to get the benefit of giving back and doing something good for your community or for to help out people you love that might be dealing with those issues or whatever it is, but we do it for social reasons. We do it for more fulfillment, and the more that we enjoy it, the more we're going to want to keep doing it, and we're going to grow it into something that we couldn't even imagine when we were starting. And part of that is finding the story behind it, finding why we're doing it, and being so truly connected to that, that it's easy to explain that to other people so they can grab that vision. They can hear the story and they're like, I'm in, because I feel connected to that story as well.
Okay, my goal is walking and running. Maybe I should pivot because I'm not a runner. Walking I need to do, so that makes sense. But running, not so much. I'm just thinking maybe I should do something about idea generation. I love getting ideas. I'm really good at getting ideas for all sorts of strange things. So I need to think more about that.
Well, and I would say maybe even make a list of the 5 things you love doing. So, or that you have to do and you want to challenge yourself to do. So that's the other piece. If you want to challenge yourself already to get into better shape and you want to walk 100 kilometers or in a week or 500 kilometers in a month, you know, already you have a goal. You're doing it for a reason, for say health or getting in better shape, but you can add on other reasons to help keep you connected to that goal and keep you driving to achieving that goal.
So actually also if fundraising is not your main goal, it could still be a way to make your goal more interesting for yourself and make you more motivated to do it.
Yeah. I don't know what it's like in Copenhagen, but recently over the last few months here, there's been a lot of stories coming out of people riding their bikes or running long distances. Someone rode their bike, I think, across the country, and it was a goal that they had personally, but they, like we did with the motorcycle tour, they decided to attach a charity to this, and they raised thousands of dollars because as they were doing their ride or their run, someone did a long run as well during the pandemic, as they were doing that, they start to gain more and more momentum in terms of social media and news outlets picking things up or newspapers, even if it's in small towns. And then people want to know how they can support it. So if you already have this like dream of, oh, I want to walk across the country or run across the country or whatever it is that you're already wanting to do, when you can attach a charity, a fundraising philanthropic way, like piece to it, you just draw in so much other energy and attention, and it changes your focus because you're not just doing it for yourself anymore. You're doing it for something bigger and other people get on board, and that just keeps fueling that momentum.
Yeah, that is one of the ways I work. That's just figuring out what works best for you, because that is what's going to get the most money raised for whatever it is you want to support.
Yeah. And I think that most of us would ultimately admit that we work best when we have deadlines and accountability. And so when we, if we just put a goal out there, we may or may not achieve it. But the more deadlines, the more accountability, the more people we have watching us, the more we're going to achieve it. And so every one of those pieces, by adding a fundraising piece or connecting to a charity or putting it out there to the public in news stories or on your social media and things like that, that just adds the pressure to us of being like, I am going to get this. Like, there's no way I'm not going to achieve this.
I agree. I totally agree. Okay, I want to jump to the total different end of the spectrum. That was the word I was looking for.
Okay.
I'm really killing it today with the not knowing the words.
It's the weekend. It's okay.
Yeah. And it's, well, I can't even say it's late, but it's later here. Okay. So doing the black tie events, I'm very curious. You said, like, when the first job you got, you said that you had a 1-year contract. Is that how long a black tie event takes to set up, or how long would it take to set up this huge black tie event, and how many people were there, and what was the fundraising part of it? I'm guessing, based on what I see in movies and hear, that a lot of the fundraising is based on people's ticket, so they buy a seat or they buy a table, and that's part of the fundraising, and a lot of places have these raffles and stuff, but how would it work for what you've been set up? What did you see work best, and how long does it take to set up?
That's a big question. There's a lot that can go into that. So let me see if I can make it somewhat succinct.
Thank you.
A year is the most time I've ever had for something like a black tie event. You need a little bit more time, the bigger it is, like the more number of people, but a year to me is a long span of time. Most events, I would say 6 to 9 months, because there's a lot of pre-work before you even put it out for ticket sales. And then there's a little bit of wrap-up work. It's another thing I love about events is that when they're done, you have like about a month of thank you notes and wrapping up and paying bills and reports and stats and stuff like that. But then it's done and you can close the book on it fully. It's not like that endless inbox, you know, where it just, every time you take something and put it in the outbox, more is in the inbox, which I don't like that kind of work. So generally for a formal type black type event, I would say 6 to 9 months, but not full time in that whole time. Any kind of event work kind of starts really slowly and then it's kind of like a gradual climb up a mountain until you reach this peak, and then it happens and it's like all the time, 24/7 for a few weeks, because so many deadlines and print deadlines and scripts and production schedules and everything like that. And then it drops off hugely and you're just like almost nothing right after, which is good because you have to recover. So that's it for time schedule. In terms of what goes into it, most of the black tie events that I've worked on have had a committee, a volunteer committee of anywhere from 10 to 30 people. And a lot of your time is actually spent managing and communicating with them and preparing things for them and answering questions, because they're the ones that are going to go out and sell tickets to the people and groups that they know. And they're also the ones that are going to get auction items. Most black tie events have an auction attached to them, some kind of an auction, whether it's a live auction or a silent auction. They often have a raffle. So for fundraising revenue streams, there's often a raffle, there's an auction. There might be a silent and a live auction, or there might be one or the other. They often have something called that I call fund a need, which is when they tell a story about a specific need that the organization has. With the Cancer Society here, they run a camp called Camp Good Times for kids that are dealing with most likely life-ending cancer. And they can't be in a lot of the regular public camps and stuff because of germs or they've lost a limb, or they've have other disabilities based on their experience. And so they run this camp, and it's a life-changing experience for these kids who feel like an outsider everywhere else, or that people are always looking at them, where they can be with other kids who have been through the same thing. So the Cancer Society, their fund a need might be raising money to send those kids to camp, because cancer treatments, all the things, like parents can't always work full-time, they're generally hurting more for money when you consider all of the financial implications of having a child with a life-threatening disease. And so the Cancer Society would do this special moment in the event where they'd show a video of the camp. They maybe would have a child come up and talk about their experience, tell their story and what the camp did for them. And then they would ask people to pledge to send kids to camp. And so they would break it down like, oh, it costs, let's say $500 a week. I have no idea if this is the right number, but they'd put a dollar value on it. It costs $500 to send a kid to camp for a week. We want to send 1,000 kids to camp this summer. So this is our goal for raising money. And then they would ask people, who wants to send 10 kids to camp? Who wants to like donate $5,000? How about 5 kids at $2,500? And people would just like raise their hand or raise their live auction paddle, their number or whatever. And they would raise money that way where it's attached to a specific program that the organization was doing. And so that's a fund a need. And a lot of charities do that. Most of the events that I do now, we don't do that because I feel we're already asking people to spend a lot for the ticket to buy their black tie outfit. You know, women like to have a new dress. Men can rent a tux and it doesn't matter. Or they can have one tux and they can wear it like event after event and it doesn't matter. But women like to have a dress, new shoes, hair, makeup, the whole thing. My volunteers would often go and have their hair done and their makeup done and their nails done, you know, all those kind of things. And maybe they're renting a hotel room for the night so they don't have to drive home. There's a lot of money that goes into attending an event like that. And then we're continually asking them to bid in the auction, to buy a raffle ticket and stuff like that. I like to focus what they're doing and to realize that they've already spent money on their tickets or their tables, which can be a sponsorship amount. So that's another revenue stream, is a whole sponsorship program. Here it works. So you would have sponsors at different levels where they would get their logos or their names attached to things. So years ago, this one event that I have done called the Bacchanalia Gala, we got a sponsor at, I don't even remember what our title sponsor was at that time, but let's say $50,000. And so then their company name or whatever name they want to use is attached to the name of the event. So in that case, this company isn't around anymore. They've been bought out, but it was the Bacchanalia Gala presented by Goldcorp or presented by whatever company is coming in to sponsor. And it's because they're already committed to the community. They have a mandate to support organizations, communities that match up with what they want to do. There's so much that goes into different aspects of fundraising that we can't even barely touch on in a short podcast. But there's different revenue streams, sponsorship, ticket sales, fund a need, auctions, raffles. There's games you can play at events. That you can charge people small amounts, tons of different games, like balloons where people buy a balloon and that one balloon has a prize. Kind of like a raffle, but everybody buys a balloon. They have them all attached to their chairs. So you see the room filled with balloons and then everybody pops them at the same time to find out who gets the prize. And you look around the room and you can go, oh, they haven't got any balloons yet, right? And then there's another game called Heads and Tails that literally is like flipping a coin, but people get physically into it. So heads, you get everybody who's playing to stand up. And then before you flip the coin, you say, okay, choose heads by putting your hand on your heads or tails by putting your hand on your rear. And everyone has to hold it there. You flip the coin and then whatever it comes up, say it comes up heads, everyone who's got their hands on their heads stays standing. And everybody who had their hands on their tails sits. And you do that until you've got less than 10 people left and you bring them up on stage to do the playoff and someone again wins a prize. So there's lots of ways to do things like that. And large companies will often sponsor prizes, like airlines will sponsor prizes for stuff like that because they get their name out there. So there's so many different ways of raising money at an event like that. It's not just one thing.
I love these small games. I think that's amazing because there's no cost to it. I know that you would have to have a lot of people there already to make this possible, but for an additional thing, and it didn't need to be, I guess, expensive to buy a ticket for it or a balloon or whatever it would be.
Oh yeah, it could be $20. So it's something that everybody could participate in. You're still raising some money. You hopefully get the prize donate it. Now, I will say, just to make sure I cover all my bases, if you're doing any of these things, you need to know what the rules are, the laws are in your area, province, country. Here in BC, these are all considered games of chance, like playing the lottery, and they require a license to do this. It's a pretty simple process, and I think the license costs anywhere from $25 to $50, but you need to have a license. You need to cover your bases properly. So I would recommend that if anybody wants to do anything like this, that they make sure what the legalities are so they don't get a fine down the road.
That's a really good advice. Okay, I have so much information in my head, and I have a dream of putting on this huge live event at some point. That's going to be a 12-hour event.
I would recommend people, the bigger an event gets, the more you want to ask for help from an expert, because there are so many things that you just don't think of. Like, you think, oh, hey, I want to do this event. Well, and today, given pandemic and so many rules around events, not that the pandemic will be here forever, but I think some of the rules will be in place for a lot longer. So at least talk to an expert, like on a consulting basis, at the very minimum, to kind of help you get your head around what you can do, how to structure it, what some of the questions you should ask are. It doesn't have to be hiring someone like me to run the whole event. However, having said that, if you are the main person of the event, if you're like, and the charity or the person bringing together everybody, you don't want to be the one running around backstage dealing with things like a flood. You need to be in front to be with your guests, to be telling them the story of why you're raising money and be available for that. You need to connect with the people who have bought tickets. And you don't need to be doing all the background stuff like fixing sound or making sure people are where they're supposed to be when they're supposed to be there. I've made that mistake before with my own event where I tried to do it all, and you can't do it all. And you're going to raise the most dollars. You're going to have the best result if you are available for your guests and you leave the running around, the things that can go wrong in the background to someone who knows how to deal with it. And you can relax.
Yeah, thank you for that, because I'm also like, I'm just saying, okay, so I'm just going to do everything myself. I'm just going to plan it. I'm just going to do it. And I know when I do stuff like that, I'm going to be so beat. And if you're doing like a black tie event, or for me, like a 12-hour event, if I need to be all over, I wouldn't be present at where I want to be. I would all the time be thinking, do we have this under control? Do we have this under control? And I wouldn't be able to be there for whatever it is I'm supposed to be there for. So thank you for that.
Exactly. I mean, think about it this way. How many of us have planned a birthday celebration or a dinner party? And we know what goes into, let's say for a dinner party, like if it's multi-course and stuff, you're worried about your guests. You're worried about getting the food out on time so that it's not overcooked. You're worried about what's going on in the kitchen. And if you don't have help in the kitchen, you're spending more time in the kitchen than with your guests. And multiply that by 100 or 1,000, like with a bigger event and with more goals. And that's like, you have to be free to be with the guests because you have to be free to be there to communicate why you're raising money, why this is so important to you. And you want to enjoy all the work you've put in for months. And so be there. And at the very least, hire someone to consult at the beginning to come help you with a strategy, and then hire someone to run things that day so that you can be present at the event with your guests and enjoy your hard work, and someone else can deal with all those little details.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay, amazing. Okay, so I think I only have two questions left. Well, three maybe. So just also to respect your time. So I'm thinking, how many people are in these black tie events? What's a good amount of people to have space for?
Okay. That's actually a hard question because it depends on your venue. It depends on what your ultimate goals are and where you're starting. I've done black tie events for everywhere from about 110 to 1,000. And so there's a wide range, and it really depends on also what the charity thinks they can pull in for something like that. Because for the most part, I haven't had to market my events. I've created the collateral, which is like invitations or posters or evites or, you know, things like that. Or I've had it created. I'm not a graphic designer, but I know what I want. So I can hire someone to do that. But in general, the charity that I've worked with or the organization I've worked with has their own reach already and those people that will support them. So it's best to kind of say to them, if you're wanting to do a black tie event for a charity that you work with or that you're involved with, find out from them what they think the capacity of their donors are, what the interest level is. And if they say, well, we're not sure, so we don't want to commit to an event for 500, start small. It's better to sell it out and have a demand for tickets and then over deliver than to like be struggling to fill half the room. Yeah. So I would say always start in the smaller and then grow from there. And if you start at 150 and you sell that out in a month, hopefully you have a venue where you're like, hey, we can sneak in 5 more tables. So we've got 50 more tickets or whatever, like to account for that demand. There are tricks around doing that so the room doesn't look empty. There's lots of tricks.
Yeah, I could imagine. Okay, so second last question is, what is the most money, if you know, you have raised at a single event?
Well, what I can say, because I do know this one, not specifically, but I did a weekend of events for a brand new organization back probably 7 or 8 years ago now. And it was brand new. It was the first events they did. We had 3 events over the course of the weekend. We had a dinner at a private home under tents in the yard with a private concert with, they were at that time called the Canadian Tenors. Now they're just the Tenors. And so we had that, and it was like a 4-course dinner, I believe, including a reception with a harpist. Like it was like super high end. And then the next day we had a cocktail party at a private home again with, there was a quartet there. There was wine and oysters, like appies and stuff like that. And it was all stand up around a pool, beautiful, like Mediterranean looking place that was followed immediately by a public concert with the Tenors with some other people at a very close by venue, concert hall. And that weekend raised over $1 million, which was unheard of for a brand new charity.
Wow.
So yeah. So that's, I would say that's the biggest one in terms of saying brand new charity, like nobody knew who they were and we raised over $1 million. Over the course of my fundraising events career, I've helped charities raise over $12 million net. So that's minus expenses. That's not the gross number. But so where $12 million has directly gone to help their programs, not pay for the event.
For one event?
One weekend event was $1 million.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking about the 12 million.
Oh, no. That's over the course of all the events that I've worked. When you take away all the expenses, $12 million net is a significant amount of money. So because most large scale events, I would say on average, maybe 200 to 300,000, like net after expenses.
So that's my goal.
There you go.
300,000 US dollars. Yeah. Not well. I think I'm going to go for 1 million. It's just easier. It's
oh, yeah. Easier. Give yourself a big goal. Yeah,
exactly.
Stretch.
Exactly. Who's going to stop me, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. And the last thing is, if people want to get a hold of you, where can they find you?
Well, so I'm all over Facebook. I have a lot of stuff going on. But my events company is called Events That Excel by Kelly Snyder, my name. I am also on Instagram, Events That Excel. And I'm on Pinterest. And then I have other stuff going on, like a podcast, which is all about story. So I've touched on it here. Our stories and our charity stories and the stories of why we're doing things are so important. And so I'm all about integrating stories into everything that we do, but in particular into fundraising and personally, because that's how we inspire, encourage, and motivate others to donate, to get involved, to give, and to do something themselves. So I have my podcast called Epic Exchanges, and I'm working on a website. I've got a lot happening, but
I will link all the links you're sending me. I will put them in the show notes. So if
Perfect.
The listener or viewer in this case would like to get a hold of you, they can go into the show notes and we will share them there.
Perfect.
Thank you so much for joining me, Kelly. It's been amazing to hear. And I have a million more questions, but I will leave them for another time.
We can do this again.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
This has been fun. I love going back and remembering the events I've done and the fun memories. So it's awesome. Thank you.
Thank you for helping me out.
Anytime.
There were so many great things in this interview with Kelly. I'm just going to touch a small portion of them. I love that she sat down and actually figured out what is it that she loves to do and then went for that, because that gives so much more drive. And also that don't do what others have done. Just, of course, you can do part of it, but remember to make it your own, because it again gives you so much more drive to do something that makes sense in that way. And in relation to this, she also mentions the list of five things you love to do and start that, and then attach a charity, like for example walking and running, and then attaching a charity to that, like we spoke to, and I totally forgot the name now, this is embarrassing, but in one of the earlier episodes I talked to this great woman in the UK, and they were biking and walking, and they raised money for blood clotting or anti-blood clotting. That was amazing. And also a small idea of when you do an event, actually thinking about, okay, so how much money do people use around the event to actually go to it, to figure out what kind of money raising or fundraising you would do, because that would also mean that you should think about, okay, so do I want to make this a really posh event to go to, or would you rather make it a bit smaller or a bit less posh and then have people donate more? So have those thoughts as well. So that's it for today. Thank you for listening. I hope you will listen in on the next episode, where I'm speaking to someone who has MS. So I'm really excited for that episode as well. Have a really, really great day. Thank you for listening to the Fund with Fundraising podcast. I'm your host, Deanna Lund. And if you want to get a hold of me, you can find me on Instagram at Fund with Fundraising, or you can email me at Deanna@smartbusinessplanning.com. Enjoy your week.